Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare, and since we don't have a quorum, we're sort of a subcommittee, correct, staff? But I think we'll jump to the opening of public hearing on Senate Bill 18. Zena?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 18 repeals antitrust exemption for coordinated care organizations, and there's no revenue impact, but there may be a fiscal impact, but no statement has been issued.
Okay, great. And we would like to have Senator Shields start us off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields, and I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate District 22. I also drafted Senate Bill 18, which removes the antitrust exemption that coordinated care organizations currently enjoy. Now, a lot of folks have asked me the background of Senate Bill 18. There is a long answer and a short answer to that question. I will save you from recounting the history of antitrust law in this country, but the premise of this bill is that there are historical, economic, and ethical reasons why we have antitrust laws in this country. Antitrust laws grew in direct response to the adverse effect of American monopolies on the market over the past 100 years. As such, antitrust laws are designed to ensure that markets are competitive because competitive markets ostensibly drive down costs and increase value to the consumer. Perhaps most importantly, antitrust laws also protect consumers against price collusion. A central tenet of antitrust is that competitors should never be allowed to exchange information about pricing and reach agreements about what price to pay or to charge. Such behavior has and can continue to reduce competition and output while increasing the price. Just today, hot off the presses, the United States Supreme Court released their decision on North Carolina State Board of Dental Examiners versus the Federal Trade Commission. The ruling addresses state statutory immunity and antitrust violations. The court ruled that the state dental board did not have antitrust immunity because the state had not provided active supervision. Let me read that again. The court ruled that the state dental board did not have antitrust immunity because the state had not provided active supervision. The opinion argues that state entities, quote, controlled by active market participants pose the very risk of self-dealing the supervision requirement was created to address. This conclusion does not question the good faith of the state officers, but rather is an assessment of the structural risk of market participants confusing their own interests with states' policy goals, close quote. Turning to Oregon and our coordinated care organizations, I'm not arguing the merit of coordinated care organizations. I was part of the process to ensure that that bill got passed. There is very good reason why we undertook healthcare transformation. However, I have not heard any reasonable explanation for why we need to confer such a broad antitrust exemption to CCOs. Coordinated care may require the sharing of information, but it should not allow the collusion of pricing. Mm-hmm. If the goal is to encourage coordination and competition, the present immunity is simply too broad. The present immunity is simply too broad and creates a perverse incentive for private health carriers and third-party purchasers to avoid competition. The immunity should either be eliminated or narrowed to provide immunity for certain specified conduct. So what we're arguing is it's way too broad, this broad antitrust exemption. If we're going to create a more focused public policy, we should have one that focuses the immunity. For example, we have immunized the setting of prices in the blackberry, grass seed, and seafood industries very specifically. So if immunity is important here, we should clearly delineate the conduct we are trying to encourage and protect from liability. Therefore, to the opponents of the bill, I ask that they testify to what specific conduct should be immunized and why. I think that's a very reasonable question. The bottom line is this: coordinated care organizations are in charge of millions of dollars of public money. However, CCO boards make decisions behind closed doors without any transparency to the public. Without transparency, we need to remove the antitrust exemption to ensure that CCOs are not colluding on price to the detriment of the public. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Questions for Senator Shields?
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
BJ Condra?
Catherine, probably.
BJ, I have Ingrid Bridolf, but then is it, there's a BJ. Some,
is it BJ? Kavner. I saw him out in the hall.
Kavner. BJ Kavner signed up for this bill. He's not. He left. Okay. Okay. All right. So Ingrid Bridolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ingrid Bridolf. I'm a partner at Davis Wright Tremaine, a law firm in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here representing HealthShare of Oregon, one of the 16 CCOs. I'll respond to Senator Shields' comments in just a minute, but if we look at the current bill, it is designed to repeal a very limited, in contrast to Senator Shields' comments, a very limited antitrust exemption. The current law, and this was part of really the formation of CCOs in Oregon and was seen by the state as fundamental to the policy behind CCOs, is to allow providers and facilities and governments and consumers to get together and collaborate and facilitate the, quote, development, implementation, and operation of CCOs. This isn't an effort to price collude. The state policy says that collaboration is needed to identify appropriate service delivery systems and reimbursement methods to align incentives for integrated care. And I think your committee and we all can agree that that is really the reason why CCOs exist. And traditionally in healthcare, there's been a lot of competition that has led to fee-for-service driving costs up. Payments to providers have gone up, care has been diminished, and the quality is not what we would all hope. And so what you were trying to pursue with CCOs is really the triple aim. And what we need is to bring those providers who are traditionally competitors together to figure out a better method for delivering the care, lowering the price, and improving the quality. So if Senate Bill 18 passes, we're going to revert to traditional antitrust policy in this country, as it applies in the state of Oregon, that discourages competitors from collaborating. And that's really what has been a problem in the delivery of health care. If we decrease the collaboration, then we jeopardize the triple aim. And I think that the primary victim will be the development of alternative payment methodologies. That's really the key. That's why people within CCOs and providers and networks that contract with CCOs get together to discuss how can we deliver this care in a different manner and what's the data that we need to review in order to develop those methodologies. Oregon's waiver and what it reports to CMS about includes one lever of the six levers that's alternative payment methodologies. And those reports that are done quarterly are there to justify the acceptance and the retention of the $1.9 billion that we rely on. Developing those alternative payment methodologies requires the collaboration among the providers. So as an example, one of the things that takes place now in reliance on this exemption is that a CCO can go out to its network of providers and say, in behavioral health as an example, we want to create a different way. We want to move away from fee-for-service, and we want to create some sort of a bundled payment mechanism. And we want to reward this quality. We don't want to pay for the churning of care. We want to require you to deliver care that's going to deliver a particular outcome. A CCO is really ill-equipped to just state what that alternative payment methodology is going to be for those providers because the CCO doesn't actually deliver the care. It's those providers that do that. So a CCO needs the expertise of the providers to come together, look at the data, discuss how they deliver care now and how they might deliver care in the future so that they can come up with something different. And that's what the CCO is looking to implement. That's what the state's depending on if we're going to deliver on the $1.9 billion promise. If the state passes Senate Bill 18 and repeals its current policy, then the new policy and the policy that the federal government will look at is that we don't have a policy that encourages collaboration among competitors. We don't have a policy that encourages people to come together, form, implement, and operate CCOs. That's gone. The statement is gone. So if I'm the FTC or I'm the State Department of Justice, I'm looking at the CCOs and saying, well, the state apparently no longer wants that type of collaboration that was necessary for your CCO to thrive. So what are we going to do? We're going to investigate those. So if I'm providers in that CCO, I'm thinking my exemption is gone. I should be concerned about what conversations I'm having. And so I'm not going to have those conversations because I don't want to risk an investigation. I don't want to risk a lawsuit from a provider or another person in the marketplace. So why would we want to do that? What's the harm here that we're concerned about? Normally with competition, as Senator Shields said, you want a lot of competition in a marketplace because you want to encourage the competition to drive down prices. In Oregon, in a different case than the dental case, and in different situations than all of the other examples that are used, the state is setting the price for this care. We know how much money there is. The legislature determines the amount of money. We're bending the cost curve as we're required to do. So there is no danger that a CCO is going to drive up costs because we control the costs. The state controls the costs. So those types of concerns that would be at play in a free market are simply not present with CCOs. We run the risk that the providers who historically have not wanted to cooperate will continue to not cooperate if Senate Bill 18 passes. And I fear that the big experiment that CCOs may fail if we can't develop those alternative payment methodologies. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Yes. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So help me understand. I mean, obviously there is the potential of one of your hospital systems to say, you know, we really need this price, and the other hospital system saying, yeah, we think we all should get that same kind of price. And then there are other providers outside who would be contracted with the CCO. So exactly what behavior is being protected here?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I don't think that behavior would be protected under current law because I don't see how a hospital system going to a CCO or going to a competitive hospital system and saying, well, we're going to demand this price. That's not a positive. That's not assisting with the development, operation, and maintenance of a CCO. There's no positive purpose there. What hospital systems could do is talk about how can we bundle services to deliver a service in a different manner, and what might that look like that would benefit this community, decrease cost, and improve quality? How would we do that? How would we go about doing that?
Follow up. So, but if that's not a violation of antitrust in the current law, why would you fight this removal of the antitrust exemption?
Because it's that latter category that I'm thinking about that would cause some concerns. Right now, in other areas of the law, what a lawyer will advise competitors to do is simply not to talk to each other about anything surrounding prices, price data points, anything that could be construed by an investigator or another competitor as being anti-competitive. So if you remove this exemption, then we go back to our traditional advice, which is you shouldn't be talking to each other. Not because the talking is illegal, but because it could be misconstrued as being something more than it was.
And what about the notion that you could follow up, I'm sorry, that you could focus it a little bit more on specific behavior rather than making a broad antitrust exemption? I mean, it basically says the bill, the original bill or the statute now basically says you're exempt from Oregon antitrust law, doesn't it?
Well, no, Madam Chair. No, it doesn't say you're exempt. It says for these purposes you're exempt and that it's the policy of the state to exempt you. That's limited.
Okay. And then last question. So what oversight does the state have to make sure that that exemption is being forthright?
So right now in the statute, the Oregon Health Authority can engage in state supervision necessary to promote its state action immunity. It can collect information. It can, there's another component here that they can do. It can inspect or request additional documentation to verify that the delivery system under ORS is being implemented in conjunction with the legislative intent. So you've got a big state actor here that's involved. It gets a lot of reports from all of the CCOs. It sets the prices. It determines the services. It sets metrics for quality, so heavily regulated.
So you would argue that that's active supervision?
Yes. And I think that was the intent.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Is it BJ Kanoa?
Kavner.
Sorry, that's a V.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And this is very embarrassing, but may I ask what bill we're speaking to?
Senate Bill 18.
Thank you. And
that is the antitrust exempting, removing the antitrust exemption for our CCOs.
I appreciate that. Essentially, we are, my name is BJ Kavner. I serve as executive director of 1-in-4 Chronic Health. We are the Chronic Health Care Collaborative in the state of Oregon. We work with all organizations to provide access to treatment and prevention for people impacted by chronic health conditions. Essentially, we are just looking for more transparency. We want to be able to work with the CCOs who, in the past, although they've had a lot going on, have been slightly intransigent to some of the questions that we've had around consumer access. So we believe that by removing this, we will be able to work towards more transparency with the CCOs and, quite frankly, to understand where our dollars are going and what we're doing and moving forward to achieve the goal of improved patient health and saving money.
Thank you.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yes.
And what's your local CCO?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I live in Portland, so we have two, Health Share and Family Care.
Part of what you're arguing, too, is that if we don't have open meetings, we need to get rid of the antitrust exemption.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, with regard to the open meetings and transparency, there was an issue that came up when the CCOs were meeting with the pharmacy directors to speak to the issue of new hepatitis C medications. And none of my colleagues who work in areas around hepatitis C and infectious disease and our community members were aware of this meeting until after it had happened. And repeatedly, we've requested to get copies of any minutes that were taken in this. And we are concerned about these meetings that impact not only patient lives, but very costly medications that are being made without the voice of the patient involved.
Thank you. Thank you very much for testifying. All right, everyone, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 18 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 93. Tina.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 93 requires prescription drugs offered under a health plan to provide reimbursement for up to 60 days' supply of prescription dispensed by a pharmacy if the prescription drug is covered by the program or plan and the drug is prescribed for a chronic condition. It requires the Board of Pharmacy to adopt a list of chronic conditions for which the 60-day supply must be reimbursed. There is a -2 amendment, and the fiscal and revenue statements have not yet been issued.
Okay, Representative Boone.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was so excited about this today that I showed up at 1 o'clock. They made me come back. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, the beautiful upper left coast. And as you can imagine, it seems like the only sector I'm working in these days is emergency preparedness and some veterans, of course. And this bill is one of the Resilience Task Force's 8 top recommendations. And so I introduce this to hopefully get this through with our long 50-year plan to get this resilience plan implemented. And this is pretty much the reason was one of the things that came up in the social aspects of the task force's work of implementing the resilience plan. Those people who especially live on the coast or in places that are out there, and in the case of a disaster, and in our case, we are planning for the big one, the Cascadia 9.0 earthquake and accompanying tsunami, will be cut off by roads and likely air and everything else and mail. And a lot of people who already get their meds by mail and they have a 90-day supply, lucky for them if they can get a renewal right before it happens, but one never knows. And currently, if you go to a pharmacy, you can only get 30 days. And if it happens on day 28 or 29 of that cycle and you're ready to go get your refill, boom, earthquake happens. You can't get it. And if you're on blood pressure meds, thyroid, diabetes, anything chronic like that, it could be a real problem. And this could, you know, add to the harm and trauma that would happen in the case of these disasters. So, and so anyway, that's why I'm here, and my sidekick, Mr. Cross, will introduce himself and talk about the Dash 2 amendment that he's got. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists and the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. And we got involved in this working with Representative Boone and actually a couple of your committee members in terms of trying to make this work even better. And the Dash 2 amendments would be actually a change of 60 days to 90 days and allow for a more logical approach to these discrepancies in payment and dispensing that we see between what some of the 90-day supply dispensaries have through their pharmacy benefit managers versus then the opportunity at a local level to get that kind of medication. So this would allow for the same protocols that pharmacy benefit managers have. If you've you received your initial medication, 30-day medication, and it's proved efficacious, and they approve a 90-day dispensing, then you could obviously get that through their pharmacy, oftentimes outside of the state, remote, or you could, acquire it through your local pharmacy. So that's what the Dash 2 amendments would do, and we'd ask for your support.
Have had some people talk to me regarding this bill, and they will come and testify, but I have questions regarding, like, blood pressure med. I can see that being 90 days. Contraceptives, I can see that being 90 days. But there may be some prescriptions, and I think the good doctor to my left here would probably know what that is. It may not be good for 90 days. And so will this bill allow the pharmacies to, by rule, determine which pills they could or could not?
Madam Chair, no, the prescriber will denote what the prescription is, the length of the prescription, 30 days, 3 days, 3 months. So that's all done by the prescriber. The pharmacist just dispenses.
Thank you. Madam Chair, yes. If I may, since you asked about this, I would say a couple of things. First is, off the top of my head, while there certainly are medications that need to be refrigerated, if you're going to have them at home for a while, which poses a whole separate set of issues for emergency preparedness. Most of them can be held for now. I mean, I can't think offhand of a medication that I've ever prescribed that wouldn't be good for 90 days as long as it was held under proper conditions. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is that one of my biggest frustrations, putting my physician hat on for a minute, and one of my patients' biggest frustrations is when for some reason certain plans only allow them to get 30 days for certain medications, and yet their conditions are well controlled, they travel on business a lot, but they're going to be away in the window when their prescription is allowed to be renewed. As Representative Boone pointed out, there are often rules about when you can actually get it refilled. It has to be no more than a week ahead of time or two. You know, it depends on how long the prescription's for. So I really think that from a perspective of not only emergency resilience, emergency preparedness, which absolutely is a critical point here, but also from an economic productivity issue, from a patient's not having to I don't want to spend my time, my staff doesn't want to spend their time on the phone refilling medications or interacting with pharmacies every 27 seconds for our patients. More expensive. It adds to costs, and it decreases control of important chronic conditions. The bill does allow for there to be rules established about which chronic conditions would be included. And I personally, as a physician, would say that I wouldn't want this to apply to a drug that was being applied newly, right? So I say to my patient, let's try you on this drug for your blood pressure, just to use an example, and I'm going to give you 30 days. I don't want them getting 90 days right off the bat because I don't know if that blood pressure medicine is going to work for them. I would think it should only apply to medications that for which there's an established efficacy for that patient and for specific conditions as established by the health authority. So that would be my only thought about this, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I had concerns. I think Senator Steiner Hayward probably alleviated some of them. I was thinking, I'm not sure about Schedule 2, but if it's physician discretion, I think most physicians would probably, if somebody's on an opioid, they'd probably want to be checking with them a little more often than that. So I do think 90 would probably be better, and I would point out to Representative Boone that you're doing 60 and you're worried about what happens at day 29. Same thing could happen at day 59.
Good point. So. And I would address your concern, Senator. That was discussed, but then these were also discussed back within the last 2 years, actually, during the formulation of the plan, and people repeatedly brought this up, but what about? And in Cannon Beach, we have caches and people have stored away food, clothing, things like that, and it came up and it says, well, what about our meds that we take every day? And you know, I wasn't in on all those conversations, but the intent is for the prescribing doctor to have the say on what it is. And I think it's mostly for what people talked about in the discussions were things where you've been taking this drug for 10 years, 12 years or whatever, and it works for you. And like you said, the day 29, day 59, whatever. But it's a pain. I've been overseas before and couldn't get enough to take with me. And thank God for Swedish pharmacies.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, your concern about the Schedule 2 narcotics is a valid one, and the Dash 2 amendments would remove the Schedule 2 from any kind of 90-day scheduling. That does remain 30 days. It also, the Dash 2 amendments would also, in response to Senator Steiner Hayward's concern about the efficacy of a new medication, and puts in a 30-day, before you can do a 90-day prescription, you would need to have that first 30 days demonstrating that to the prescriber that is an efficacious medication, and then it could be permitted if the prescriber goes ahead and writes a 90-day.
Thank you. BJ? Kevner?
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Once more, my name is BJ Kavnor. I am the executive director of 1-in-4 Chronic Health, and we work with patients that are living with chronic health conditions. And I appreciate the offer to speak before you today and to give our support to this measure. One of the greatest barriers that patients have in being able to maintain health is simply access to their medications. And one of the most simple things that we can do is provide patients with the medications they need. And let me be specific. I'm talking about patients that are living with chronic conditions and take the same medication day after day, month after month, and in many cases, year after year. We want to make sure that there are safety mechanisms in place for patients who are beginning a new therapy to be certain that they're working with their healthcare provider and following the rules and the advice of their provider. We don't want to extend these prescriptions to opiates, Schedule II medications. Why put unnecessarily things in place that are harmful or potentially harmful? And lastly, I can tell you as a patient, once a month I take all of my meds and supplements and I put them in a month's worth of pill boxes. And if I were able to do this for 2 months' worth of pill boxes, it would make me very, very happy. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lisa Tressel, Robert Judge, and Elizabeth Ranley. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Tressel with HealthNet, Health Plan of Oregon, and coming at, with some concerns on Senate Bill 93, and the explanation that Representative Boone gave was helpful. We currently offer, you can get 30 days worth of most well, 30 days prescription at the retail pharmacy. If you do mail order, you can get 90-day on most prescriptions, and you don't have to pay the three different copays through mail order. So if the bill would allow, however, and the Dash 2s may take care of it. I haven't looked at them. I will. But there are concerns with particularly some chronic conditions with the very high cost, up to $10,000 a month drugs. I think that right now those very expensive ones we do not give out for 90 days through mail order. So a lot would depend on what the conditions are that are determined to be chronic, but and also allowing us to use our normal process as far as instead if we have a 90-day availability through the mail order, then to continue to allow that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Robert Judge. I'm the Director of Pharmacy Services at Moda Health. Moda Health is a Northwest-based health plan, formerly known as ODS, if you're more familiar with that, or the Moda Center. We cover about 1.2 million lives under a pharmacy benefit, but we offer medical, dental, and pharmacy insurance in Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. I'm appearing in opposition today to this piece of legislation for several reasons. The first is that, Senate Bill 93 would increase costs for payers and consumers. Oftentimes, patients who are newly diagnosed with a chronic condition, and we kind of had this touched on, have medications that go through changes as we have a failure in therapy or a change in dosage by a prescriber. So patients who are newly diagnosed may, as current written, and I haven't read the Dash 2 in detail, but as in its current incarnation, could have up to a 60-day quantity of medications prescribed and have that therapy changed a week later, which would increase cost to the consumer in terms of copayments and to the payer in terms of the drugs that they're spending or paying the pharmacies to fill. The second is that it limits the ability for insurers, self-insured groups, and to use the most clinically appropriate and cost-effective distribution channel for medications for patients who've got chronic conditions. And we've heard through other testimony that when a patient gets stabilized on a medication, they want to have that medication come in on a regular basis and be able to get it. From a payer's perspective, we develop distribution channels that provide the right clinical coverage, but also try to do so most cost-effectively. And that gives us the options for 30-day fills in retail, which deals primarily with acute medications or short-duration uses. And then we give the option to our patients to get 90-day fills through mail at rates that could save them a copay and certainly saves our clients money on their drug spend. And I will say that, you know, one of our primary clients here would be a state client that would see its drug prices increase, and I think you'll see that in the fiscal notes that come out through this effort. As a former pharmacy owner, I understand the game and the battle that gets played between a pharmacy and a payer for volume, and no pharmacy wants to see volume leave its doors. That's an elected choice in many cases in this state for patients to use a less expensive option for themselves, giving pharmacies the ability to essentially have without a payer's recourse to set standards for distribution, I think upsets that balance field, and it's fairly self-serving from my perspective from a former pharmacy owner. The third item really, I think, gets to a problematic area. And this is it assigns to Board of Pharmacy to establish what a list of chronic conditions. I think that usurps the responsibility for what a provider does, a prescriber, a physician does, who diagnoses a patient and determines the course of treatment for that patient. By having Board of Pharmacy sit in that role, I think it oversteps their responsibility. And it creates a challenging issue for payers to respond to, because when prescribers write prescriptions, there's never a diagnosis on that prescription. So that prescription comes in, and as a payer, we just know it's a prescription and how it gets treated. It could be used for off-label purposes that are not chronic. An example is metformin, which is a diabetic medication typically used for a chronic condition, but it could also be used for infertility, which is not a chronic condition. We have beta blockers, atenolol and propranolol, which are used to treat blood pressure. That can be used for anxiety. As a payer, we have no way of knowing under this legislation what that medication is going to be used for, because there's no diagnosis codes on prescription tabs from providers. So there's some challenges with this legislation in its current incarnation that makes it very difficult to implement and problematic. And for those reasons, we're in opposition to it.
Question?
Ms. Remley. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of Cambia, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I'd like to echo what both HealthNet and MOTA have outlined here. We have concerns about Senate Bill 93 because we think that it expands pharmaceutical distribution beyond what could be cost-effective or clinically appropriate for certain drugs. And we also have major concerns about the authority that we are giving to the Board of Pharmacy around the list of drugs. And so I think that Robert here has done an excellent job outlining these issues, and we are here to echo that and to say that we are in opposition to Senate Bill 93.
Thank you. No further questions? Thank you very much. I would like to get input from members, and if everyone's in agreement, we probably will move this bill. But I would like everyone to look at the dash twos, because I think that's what I've heard that maybe people would like. Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 93. And colleagues, we need to open a work session on introduction of committee measures.
Madam Chair, I move LC 1378 dated 2-24-15 and LC 2939 dated 2-20-15 be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Cruz moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills, LC 1378 dated 2-24-15 and LC 2939 dated 2-20-15. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I would like to close that work session on introduction committee measures and open a work session on Senate Bill 547. See not. Bring us up to date.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 547 permits the Oregon State Board of Nursing to issue a nurse emeritus license. It permits the licensee to engage in nursing on a voluntary or non-compensatory basis. There's a dash one amendment which replaces the certified registered nurse with clinical nurse specialist. And there is no revenue impact and a minimal expenditure impact.
Okay.
Ready?
We need to drop the dash ones.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 547.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 547. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
I'm trying to move Senate Bill 547 as amended with the dash one amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 547 with the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Excused.
Senator Cano.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and I will carry the bill, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 547, and open a...
And you will carry it, by the way.
Yes, I'm carrying it.
Okay.
I think we'll jump to this one, right? Is Sandy still here? Okay. So should we have this first? Yeah. Okay, I would like to open the informational meeting on the Joint Interim Task Force on Primary Mental Health Healthcare reimbursement, because Sandy is here.
Rick Kincaid.
But Rick Kincaid will please come forward. Is Sandy here?
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to address this committee. My name is Rick Kincaid. I'm a family medicine physician practicing in Eugene, Oregon. I serve as the co-chair for the Joint Interim Task Force on Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement. The task force is composed of physician, nurse practitioner, physician assistant providers, as well as insurance representatives and legislators. I'm here to fulfill the intent of House Bill 2902 in reporting the findings of the task force from their deliberations over the last 12 months. And I believe all of you have access to the full report of the task force on OLIS. Our task force was primarily to examine three things: payment structures related to the reimbursement of primary and mental health care services, payment structures and their effect, and other efforts that would specifically support the workforce in primary care and mental health, as well as the fairness of payment structures, specifically as they relate to the differential payments to physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. I'd like to provide the committee with brief highlights and key findings from the work of the task force. First of all, with respect to fair payment practices for providers. Inequities, the committee found that inequities indeed existed prior to the action of House Bill 2902. And the evaluation of the compliance of the new regulations set forth in House Bill 2902 are in process by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we hope to have that completed this spring. Given that, we recommend that the sunset clause, which is contained within House Bill 2902, remain intact until we are confident there is full compliance with the regulations of that bill. We also request clarity with respect to the definition of independent practice, which I believe will be discussed further in later sessions with Senate Bill 153.
Which we will hear next.
Correct. So it is on the agenda. So I'm looking forward to that. The second thing is that for support with respect to the workforce, the task force recognized that there is a significant provider shortage throughout many areas and many communities in Oregon with respect to primary care and behavioral health, mental health services. Those reasons for those shortages are multifactorial, but largely economic. The task force is confident that the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Policy Board's Healthcare Workforce Committee are adequately addressing this issue. And other than efforts to improve the payment structure for primary and mental health care, further committee discussion related to this issue is likely not necessary. The task force does recommend continued efforts to provide loan repayment for primary care providers, as well as to increase funding potentially for additional residency in primary care and mental health, as well as advanced practice training for advanced practice clinicians in primary and mental health services. Thirdly, we addressed alternative payment methodologies. The task force wants to acknowledge the work that was commissioned by the Oregon Health Authority to study alternative payment methodologies, because and out of that work came five key findings which we wanted to highlight: that alternate payment methodologies can be effective in both increasing quality and decreasing cost, that there is support for continued implementation of alternative payment models, but that there is no one-size-fits-all model. Reform efforts need to continue at a local level and need to involve all stakeholders. And to be successful, it's about building relationships. The task force also recommends that continued efforts be made to create a uniform multi-payer payment model for primary care medical homes, and studying the impact of current alternative payment methodology work that's going on within the CCO environment within the state. And finally, the task force recognizes that once it is assured of the intention of House Bill 2902 is fulfilled with respect to fair payment, that there may need to be a reconfiguration or redeployment of the task force members to specifically address the complex issues of payment reform. We anticipate that we will have further recommendations in the coming months related to that. I would like to thank my co-chair, Mary Grant, as well as members of the task force, and for their commitment in examining a relatively complex and broad set of issues, as well as their dedication to, in general, improving the health of Oregonians. I would also like to thank our staff support for this task force, Sandy Thiel, CIRCA. I'm happy to answer questions, Madam Chair.
Well, first of all, Dr. Kincaid, I want to thank you for all of your work and time that you put into this. I listened in on most of the meetings that you had, and I thought you were extremely thorough and spent a lot of time on this.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I've heard anecdotally about how a number of, just in the last year, nurse practitioners around the state have had to close shop because of provider or carriers not honoring this law like they should. Have we looked at whether or not there's been an improvement or decrease of primary care providers generally, or particularly nurse practitioners around the state in the last year?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, that is the intention of the work that's currently underway with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We've asked them that very specific question, and they have administered a series of surveys to payers to understand their process and methodology around their payments for services for independent practice providers, which include physician assistants, as well as nurse practitioners. As far as the impact of the actions that have happened in the past, we do believe that there has been impact, and this does need to be addressed.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions. All right, with that, I'd like to open a public hearing, or I'll close the informational meeting and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 153. Zena?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 153 clarifies the definition of independent practice. It requires that insurance reimbursement of primary care or mental health services by physician assistants and certified nurse practitioners in independent practice uses the national provider identifier of the physician assistant or nurse practitioner or facility in which the physician assistant or nurse practitioner provides services. There is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
I don't have who signed up for this bill? Sarah.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 153, which, as you've just heard, is a technical fix to the definition of independent provider that was included in the payment parity legislation that was passed in 2013. You'll recall during the 2013 legislation required that private insurers reimburse nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and physicians the same rate when they're providing the same primary care or mental health services and billing under the same code. The definition of independent provider included in that bill specified that in order to be eligible for full reimbursement, the nurse practitioner or physician assistant had to bill under their own name and their own national provider identifier, or NPI. The intent of this definition was to cover NPs and PAs who were seeing their own patients and not billing their services incident to a physician. In the course of the implementation of this legislation, we've learned that sometimes services are billed using the provider's name and the clinic NPI instead of the provider NPI. This is something that's sometimes required by the insurer. And in some cases, the insurer then won't reimburse the full rate because the service is billed using the clinic NPI instead of the provider NPI. Although the standardized claim form does require that the provider include both their clinic and provider NPI. Senate Bill 153 would correct this so that it would require the full payment if the claim is billed using the provider's name and NPI and or the clinic's NPI. The Oregon Nurses Association and the Task Force on Mental Health and Primary Care Reimbursement that you just heard about explored this issue with the Insurance Division, and because the problematic definition of independent provider is in statute, it does require legislation to fix it. We are very pleased to see clarifying this definition as one of the recommendations coming out of the task force. We think Senate Bill 153 achieves that goal, and we'd encourage your support.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Kincaid, would you come up just for a brief? Ms. Basler said that you had addressed this particular issue on the task force, and I just wanted you to introduce yourself again and put that on the record that this was a recommendation from the task force.
Madam Chair and committee members, the actual language of Senate Bill 153 we have not been able to review as a task force. Our task force recommended that there be legislative clarity around the definition.
Okay.
And that was also supported, as Sarah said, by the Insurance Commission because of the fact that it was interpreted in different ways by different insurance providers.
Thank you. Questions? All right.
Madam Chair, I just want to put on the record that my spouse is a nurse practitioner that would be affected by this bill. I'm sure as we go towards work session, I'll continue to mention that. But in the interest of transparency, I want to put that on the record for the people here.
Okay. Do people have problems with this bill? We do have a fiscal. Do we have a revenue?
There's no revenue.
Okay. We do have a fiscal, and so let's get that to all of the members and then not have a work session today, but to have people look at that. It does look like there is, MOTA projects a 0.27% premium cost increase impacting 42,478 employees, and projects a possible 1,973,305 increase in other funds for the 2015-17 biennium.
Madam Chair, with all due respect, I appreciate the fact that MoDA is probably being cautious, and I understand that, and that's their job. I would be really surprised if, I mean, this is only affecting a very small number of people based on the way we crafted the legislation in 2014. What year did we pass this? 13. From Ms. Basler's testimony, from what I've heard and what Senator Shields, I think, has heard, this is not affecting every nurse practitioner by any means. It's only affecting a few, and it's only – so I guess I'd like to understand – I mean, I guess I'd like to understand a little bit more from MoDA about why they – I mean, that's a pretty hefty increase based on what I think is a relatively small percentage of people. I'm not questioning them per se or implying that they're deliberately exaggerating. That's not my intention at all. I'm just surprised by that number.
And Madam Co-Chair, really all we're doing here is clarifying what they should have been doing since the implementation of 2902, the last bill. So
yeah.
Anyway, I don't have the fiscal in front of me.
Right.
What's the total?
It's minimal impact on Department of Consumer and Business Affairs and the OAB reports passage of the bill may increase premium costs.
Thanks.
And it really only cites MoDA.
Okay. So we wouldn't have a block from sending it to the floor. It's just.
No, because it's other funds. But we don't have the revenue, so we can't pass it anyway. And it would be
Madam
nice
Chair,
to.
That revenue is available. There's no revenue impact.
Oh, there's no revenue.
But and I would also point out that, I mean, it seems a little bit large, but actually, if you're talking about $2 million, oh, this is OWEB, basically. OWEB has about 135,000 covered lives, so I'm going to say. That's close. I can look it up, but I think that's close. And so that's less than $20 per covered life over the course of a biennium. So it's less than $10 per covered life per year, which for a family of four would be less than $40 per year. And I don't want to minimize that for some of our OEB beneficiaries, but it's not a lot. It's still higher. It's higher than I would expect, but when you actually do the arithmetic out, it's not so bad. Well, is my sense.
No one else has signed up to testify. But because the fiscal just came to us.
I mean, I don't have.
I'm comfortable passing
it. I'm comfortable passing
it.
You
are.
Tim, you good? Yeah, I think we're all fine with it.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 153 and open a work session on Senate Bill 153.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 153 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves Senate Bill 153 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to put on the record again during the work session that I have a conflict on this. My wife is a nurse practitioner that would be affected by this bill.
But just out of curiosity, does she bill under a separate NPI number under a physician, or is she independent?
She has her own practice.
So then she's not actually affected by this because she wouldn't have been, would she be?
I think she is.
Okay. I thought it was only people who are billing under a physician's NPI, but that's a clinic NPI that, never mind. Sorry.
Is there any other discussion on this issue? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Senator Cadeau.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Excused.
Chair Bonas Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries. And does someone like to carry this bill? Yes, Senator Knopel. That will close the work session on Senate Bill 153 and go to our last bill, which is Senate Bill 148. Zena.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 148 alters the Board of Pharmacy membership to add one licensed pharmacy technician and remove one member of the public. There's a -1 amendment which adds two members to the Board of Pharmacy and requires two members of the board to be licensed pharmacy technicians.
And the list? Okay, let's have Jeff Anderson and Jennifer McMahon. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555. In our 20,000 members in our local, we have about 2,500 that are employed in the healthcare sector. An interesting note, in 1989, the Senate Health Committee was sponsoring a bill that I requested by then Chair McCoy to license pharmacy techs. It was the first effort to bring licensing. Well, it didn't happen until 2005, so some ideas take a little longer to permeate. But in the process, we've always felt from the minute the law passed that Oregon's history of boards and commissions have always had stakeholder positions or stakeholders, such as when I was on the Wage and Hour Commission, or if you look at the Oregon Fescue Commission, it certainly has grass seed growers. Well, today, the pharmacy board is made up of 6,000-plus pharmacists and 6,000-plus pharmacy technicians. We were able to, in 2009, to get a pharmacy tech added to the board. However, for whatever reason, while it passed a legislative priority, it did not ultimately last for some reason. I'm not sure why. We've always wanted to represent them in the Senate Bill 148-1 amendments. We would ask that you would support those to that end, in that tradition of having stakeholder representation on this on the board. And with that, I have a pharmacy technician, one of our members, Jennifer. That I will let her tell you her story.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer McMahon. I am here to speak in support of Senate Bill 148 and the -1 amendment. I have been a pharmacy technician for 18 years and currently work at Kaiser Permanente in Salem, Oregon. My license is regulated by the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy. The board oversees my continuing education, requirements, and disciplinary processes. As a member of this profession, I feel it is important for my peers to have a voice on the board. I appreciate the board's recent efforts to survey pharmacy technicians, but it is still important that we have a voice at the table. I thank the committee for bringing this bill forward and appreciate your consideration. I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you. I have a question. Are all pharmacy techs in a union?
No.
That's what I thought. Okay. Any other questions? All righty. Marcus Watt and BJ Kavner.
BJ's out of the room.
I know. BJ's like our star witness today.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and committee members. My name is Marcus Watt, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. The Board of Pharmacy had a very thorough discussion around Senate Bill 148 during their recent board meeting. They support the addition of one pharmacy technician to the board, which would then provide technicians an important position in the regulatory board. The board supports the addition of one technician but objects to the addition of two. The mission of the board is to protect the public through the regulation of the practice of pharmacy, as well as all commerce of prescription and non-prescription drugs entering and exiting the state. The board also enforces many federal regulations set by the Food and Drug Administration, as well as the Drug Enforcement Agency. The current makeup of the board is five professional members who are pharmacists from different practice settings and two public members. The professional members' role is to provide the expertise, knowledge, and guidance of the practice of pharmacy, and the public members' role is to ensure that the board and its professional members are acting in the best interests of the public and not the profession itself. The current makeup of the board provides an ideal balance of professional knowledge along with the safeguards of having non-professional involvement and oversight. Adding two technicians to the board would create an imbalance that might not allow for decisions being made with a full understanding of professional obligations and standards. Pharmacy technicians perform an important role by assisting the pharmacist in non-judgmental tasks such as counting medications, placing labels on the vials, and entering data into the computer. They are not allowed to work independently and are prohibited from performing any activity that requires the exercise of judgment and could impact patient care. They have limited knowledge of the practice of pharmacy or the state and federal statutes and regulations that guide the profession. The Board of Pharmacy spends a minimal amount of time on technician rules, and the disciplinary cases that we have related to technicians are typically simple and non-complex in nature. The addition of two technicians to the board would be out of proportion to the amount of time dedicated to the regulation of technicians. So, in conclusion, the Board of Pharmacy supports the addition of one technician and possibly one pharmacist to make a nine-member board, but cannot support the addition of two technicians.
Okay. Have you ever...
Go ahead.
Yeah. So you like your two public members, is that correct?
Yes.
And do you have problems recruiting public members?
I believe the last recruitment took a year and a half.
For public members?
Yes, and the governor's policy advisor has advised us they do not want to see any reduction in public members on our board.
And how about the pharmacists? You have five pharmacists.
Yes.
You wouldn't consider bumping that to four pharmacists and two techs, or?
Well, it would be...
One tech?
Yeah, well...
I'm just trying to think of all possibilities here.
The three possibilities we came up with were an eight-member board, which is problematic, and I don't think that's really an option. The second option would be to add one pharmacist member and one technician member for a nine-member board, which would still sort of maintain that balance of professional to non-professionals.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, I'm sorry, if you're done.
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay, thank you. I guess I'd like to understand a little bit better what the concerns are. I mean, I understand your point that you don't spend as much time talking about assistants, technicians, as you do about pharmacists, but as a physician, just putting my physician back on for a minute, I think that my physician assistants, for example, who work with me and who also sit on the Oregon Medical Board, have legitimate things to say about standard practice among physicians because they work closely with physicians and they understand whether people are following best practices at some level. And while I understand your point that pharmacy technicians are a little different than physician assistants, I don't want to minimize the contribution that they make to ensuring that the public has access to all the services a pharmacy provides. And I do think that even if you added two and still had five pharmacists, the vast preponderance of the board would, I mean, the majority of the board, over the majority of the board, would still be pharmacists. You'd have two members of the public, two pharmacy techs. And I guess I'd like to know what you're really worried about, why this would be, I mean, do you think that they would have unrealistic expectations of pharmacists? I'm missing something.
I believe their concern was wrapped around, now, first of all, we agree with you, or the board agrees with you, and the value that they bring and the importance of having a technician on the board. There's no doubt that we would welcome that. I think some of the discomfort comes from your example of the medical board. You're dealing with healthcare professionals, people.
Mm-hmm.
Our board also deals with manufacturers, the FDA, the DEA, some really complex, interactive type regulations. And I think there's some concern there that there may not be the understanding of those or the ability to regulate that. I'm not answering your question.
Follow up, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. if I may. I'm a little troubled by that concern, to be honest with you. I mean, for two reasons. First of all, there may be plenty of people who choose the pharmacy technician path rather than the pharmacist path because of financial circumstances that are beyond their control or the inability to take time away from their families that it takes to become a registered pharmacist, but are still very intelligent and very capable of wrapping their heads around, you know, significant issues. And second, I would say that any pharmacy technician who would choose to volunteer for this position would probably be among the cream of the crop and would be somebody who cared deeply about making sure that the public was protected in all the ways possible and would, to the best of my guess, not have any hesitation in doing his or her homework and asking for help understanding issues if there were issues that were outside of their previous experience, in and would be the kind of person who would get up to speed pretty quickly. So I'm a little troubled by that concern, to be honest with you. I'm not trying to be difficult to you, sir. I'm really not, but I'm a little troubled by that assumption or that concern.
Okay.
All right. I think no one else to testify. BJ isn't here. Okay. What I'd like to do is talk with the techs and then with the board and expand a little bit on ideas for this.
Madam Chair, if I could add, we've had an ongoing dialogue with the union since last June, and it's been a very positive, interactive procedure. We've just sort of come to this point where we sort of agree to disagree. So
yeah,
we'll be happy to have for
that's
the discussions.
That's why I'll talk with you, and I will talk with you, and we'll brainstorm a little bit, and
okay,
and then we'll decide the policy. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. And is that it for the day? Okay. We're done. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 148, and we're adjourned. Public hearing on Senate Bill 148.